It's time to sit down and relax for the good, the bad, and the sequel Q&A with your host, Doug.
Hey there. So the last sequel that we did was Home Alone 3. And last week was our interview with Lenny Van Dolan. I hope you enjoyed him. He's great. Check out all of his awesome movies that he did, especially Electric Dreams. So this week we have yet another interview from Home Alone 3, and it's the dad in the movie, Kevin Kilner. Kevin's career of acting didn't start like others that you've heard us interview before. And he was recently in a play that was a satire about parents paying for their kids to get into college. I think you know where I'm going with this one. And the play was in its final week when the whole Lori Loughlin USC scandal broke out. So it got extended a few weeks and he was real busy, but we were finally able to chat. He was in a lot of great sitcoms and guest roles over the years, one of the best Frasier episodes ever. And he was a lead on a CBS show with Nancy Travis in the early 90s. And he's in probably one of the most memorable scenes besides the apple pie and in the American Pie franchise. So Kevin has some stories that will blow your mind, and I had so much fun chatting with him. Let's start the interview.
I was working on a play by Joshua Harmon called Admissions that was done at Lincoln Center last March. And I was doing it down at Studio Theater in D.C., and it just opened in London. It's been being done on the West Coast as well, and it's being read for the Pulitzer. It was even being read for the Pulitzer before the FBI probe and all that stuff blew.
Oh, really?
That was just like lightning, you know, striking. And in our play, the parents don't write checks, but they quote unquote make phone calls in the old, you know, the old fashioned way of like, let me see who I know. Do I know anybody like graduated from there? See if they can get the admissions office to look at you again. And, you know, our son gets, structurally in the play, the son gets waitlisted to Yale and the mother really wants him to go. The son really wanted to go. The father's like, you know, he'll be fine. Let him go to Dartmouth. Let him go to Duke. He's a really top student. He'll be fine. And the mother talks to the father and is, you know, saying, you know, let the kid pursue his dreams. We can at least make a couple phone calls. Well, audiences really loved it because it was a satire. It's a really, really funny play. And like from beginning to end, it's like really funny, like incredibly funny lines. And it's a very liberal couple. And like the son goes on this rant that ends up being somewhat racist where he breaks down, you know, how do you decide whether someone's a person of color or not? How do you want to slice this and dice this and go back and forth? I mean, you know, he talks about like, you know, my mother's Jewish, my father's a WASP, you know, my grandfather on my mother's side was kept out of an Ivy League school because they had super intense quotas against Jews in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. But now they found a new way to keep Jews out. They just made us white instead, you know, and the audience is like roaring at these lines. And, you know, we're doing this play and they're loving it. And we were extended, I think. We'd already been extended twice, maybe three times. Then the FBI thing hits.
That's wild.
And it's just like, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, I called my wife and I said, you know, this will never, ever happen again in my life because in less than 24 hours, I'm literally in the hottest play in America. Like they tripled their box office sales. It was crazy.
Well, and where are you performing at?
Yeah, the Studio Theater was in Washington, is in Washington, D.C.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Yeah, it was down there and, but it's just, it was, you know, I remember, you know, my agent sent it to me and when I read it, I was like about 10 pages into it and I was like, man, this guy can really write. It's really funny, really insightful, you know, really like it's a real modern satire. That's just great writing. And I'm sort of at this place in my career where I'm just following the great writing, wherever that leads. I don't care if it's Washington, D.C. I don't care if it's like some independent film in, you know, Vancouver. I don't really care. I just, wherever there's really good writing.
You know. Where's your home base, LA?
It was, but you know, my wife, before she was even my wife, Jordan and I were in LA for 15 years, but we both started in New York
Theater. Oh, nice.
And so when we turned 50, I said, you know, it's time to go back. We're theater people. And
oh, okay. So you're right by me. I'm in Jersey.
Yeah. So I live in Tappan. Tappan.
Okay.
Yeah. Where are you in Jersey?
I'm in New Providence. So right by Summit.
I don't know where that is, but is that northern, central, what?
Like central, northern. Cool. I'm about like 35 minutes from the city, like, so not that far.
Cool. Tell me about your podcast. And all. Like, I'm curious.
Yeah. So what?
When I read your idea, like there was situations, I was like, really? Someone's doing Roman numeral movies? I used to make jokes to people. I used to say, I only do movies. After American Pie 2, I literally was going around going to my acting friends. They were like, oh, I see you're in another Roman numeral movie. I said, yeah, I only do sequels and trequels.
That's great. No, I think it's like a fascinating concept. So some movies really work. So recently I interviewed, do you remember, obviously, Police Academy?
Yeah.
So I interviewed Lance Kinsey, who played Proctor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that franchise is like one of the, I think they're the exception to the rule. Because they, whoever was the casting director, whoever was involved in that, they really were able to keep like a core group of people in it.
Right.
A lot of the sequels, you get to like the third, fourth, you don't even recognize it. Like if it wasn't called, like just like those American Pie like spinoffs, they basically call it American Pie and they, the Naked Mile or
right,
Beer Pong or whatever they call them. If you didn't see the American Pie, you'd think it wasn't even affiliated. So I've always been fascinated with sequels, whether it be the good sequels or the ones that aren't as good. But I think each movie in itself, just to get a movie made, is fascinating. So some have really funny stories behind it. Like we covered Caddyshack 2,
right,
which the story behind that one's like mind-blowing. Just the fact that Rodney was like involved until they really started shooting. And then he pulled out. So that whole movie was supposed to be centered around Rodney Dangerfield. Which would have been great.
I don't know that story. Why did he pull it?
It was a whole like argument with the studio. So it was like a lot of these stories you hear about bad movies.
Yeah.
Like Speed 2 Cruise Control. So like Sandra Bullock, they were like, hey, we'll fund, I think it was Hope Floats. We'll fund Hope Floats if you do this movie. And even though Keanu Reeves wasn't in it, she still did it. So her passion movie that she wanted to get done. So it kind of happened with Rodney, but it was like this whole thing with the studio. They wanted to rush him on it. Harold Ramis was like still on board. Like he was writing it for Rodney. And then once Rodney dropped out, Harold Ramis, like he wanted to get his name off the movie. He has nothing to do with it, but it's still in the credits. And he was like upset about it. But anyway, so yeah, so just sequels. I think they in themselves have great things. And I want to start more like how you got started and then we'll get to there.
Sure.
So are you from New York?
No, I grew up in Maryland. I was born in Baltimore.
Oh, and nice.
We moved out of the city when I was four to the country. And I grew up in a real farm, kind of like a farming region. And there was a little Episcopal school up the road that my parents sent me to. And then my mom started working there. So, cause she was transitioning from being a painter to working in the classroom. They needed the paycheck. They needed a steady income. And we got to go to my sister and I got to go to the school for free. Cause she ended up getting her teacher certificate and teaching there. And she went on to touch, she became a public school teacher in Baltimore County for 25 years. So,
oh wow.
So she taught for 30 years and we lived out there and my dad was a salesman. He sold everything from shoes to cars to insurance to, advertising, direct marketing stuff. And he wasn't a great, he was a good salesman. He didn't make a lot of money, but he was a good salesman and he was a good guy. He loved stories and he loved jokes I was a hyperactive kid and truly probably, you know, today I would be just diagnosed as I was like an ADD kid and my mom had a nervous breakdown. She was like, you know, if you don't get that kid in the sports, I'm leaving this house. Like literally told my father that. And so he signed me up for football and lacrosse. And, you know, eventually I was wrestling in the winter too. And, you know, I was just always in a sport. And went to a public high school in Timonium, Maryland called Delaney High School. And then I got recruited from a couple colleges for football and, you know, two or three, four others for lacrosse. And I wanted to play lacrosse. So, and my dream had always been to play at the school I had watched the most, which was Johns Hopkins. So
yeah.
And, you know, it was a very, I was a role player. I was sat on the bench my first 2 years practically. I mean, I played a little bit my sophomore year, but mostly played my junior and senior year in a role position, but, you know, played on some great, you know, played on three national championship teams. We won three in a row. We were the first team in the modern era being defined by, they started a Final Four and an NCAA tournament in 1970. And I was playing, and we won 78, 79, 80, and we were the first team. Cornell won 76, 77. Then we beat them in 78. We beat Maryland in 79. We beat University of Virginia in 80. And then Carolina beat us in 81.
Oh, so you were at four. That's pretty phenomenal.
I was actually at five.
You redshirted?
I had had a thumb shattered in practice, a couple steel pins in it, and I redshirted in 78. And I came back and played on the practice squad, you know, being the, you know, the scout team thing. Yeah, I actually was at five national championships.
That's amazing. So what did acting come about within all the lacrosse practices? And
No, not at all. I mean, especially when I played, and the game was it's funny, I referee lacrosse now at the youth level. And
oh, wow.
And the game has been very, very progressive about getting ahead of the curve on concussion syndrome. And you can no longer declare a player, and you can't hit a player when, you know, he doesn't have both feet on the ground. If he has any part of his body, like if his hand is touching the ground or his elbow's on the ground, you can't blow him up. You can't hit him the way we could in our days. You know, you could bury guys in my day, you know, and guys were always on the ground, and guys always had concussions. I mean, you know, one of my teammates died at age 50. I mean, we figured he had over a dozen concussions.
Oh, wow.
He was fighting depression and a lot of other things. But, it was just a much rougher sport back in the day, but I'm not proud of that at all. I'm just saying that's the way it was. I'm actually grateful that the sport has been so progressive, because now it relies on athleticism, which I think all sports should. You know, basketball had its goon era, and ice hockey had its goon era, and it doesn't really work. I mean, yeah, you can goon and all that, but people just end up getting crippled for life, and it's bullshit. You know, it's like, be a great athlete, you know? So I was doing that, and I went into banking. I became a credit analyst for about a year and a half, and I was a commercial loan officer at Fortune 500 companies for a bank in Baltimore. And I hated it from the second week I was there. I you know, really hate it. By the second month I was there, I was like, this is huge. This is a huge, huge mistake. And the way I dealt with it was – I mean, I was getting depressed. I mean, the way I dealt with it was I went back to school at night. I took a couple semesters of journalism. Thought I wanted to be a journalist. A couple semesters. I wanted to write fiction writing. And during this time, I was playing club lacrosse. I played a year of played for the Baltimore Eagles for minor league football team for a year. That was probably the gutter, you know, D team for the Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, I can't imagine there was anything below us.
Were you getting paid for that?
Nah, some of the guys on the team were, you know, the quarterback was, and some of the star players were, but you know, I was just a role player there. I just wanted to play. I wanted to see if I could play still.
That's awesome.
But you know, there's fast and then there's NFL fast, and there's a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, you might think you're fast in college, and then you see guys that are going to get shots at the pros, and these guys are like lightning, you know. So
I know it's like watching. I don't know if have you had a chance to watch the AAF yet?
Not yet.
It's like it's so slow. Like plays develop so slow.
Yeah, yeah. Because guys, you know, it's just they're freakish at the pro level. They're just freakishly fast. They're incredibly quick, and you can't believe someone that big can move like that. And you're like, phew. And I remember I was playing strong safety, and I was hitting like our tight end in practice was 240, 245, and I was about 205. And I mean, you know, you're giving up 40 pounds, it's like hitting a tree. It's like, I was like, you know, maybe I can drag him to the ground because I sure as hell can't knock him to the ground. It's like, this guy's a big dude. But anyway, I quite literally in sort of like a last fling of desperation, because I think about it. I liked writing, but I didn't want to, you know, I'd been in team sports my whole life, and I was like, I'd like to work with a bunch of people creating something. And I just, you know, whether out of ignorance or arrogance or probably a combination of both, I took an adult evening, like one of those free newspapers you get on the streets of any city, you know, Baltimore. this woman taught a introduction to acting class on the second floor of this building, you know, right up like 5-6 blocks north of where the bank was. And I took it, and the first night I just was like, wow, I want to do this, you know? And I took another class. It was like an on-camera class, and people were like, you're so relaxed, you know, why? You should try this. Like, you could do this, you know, you could be good at this. And so I just made up my mind. I took another job as a branch manager at a mortgage bank, and I ended up in Dothan, Alabama. And, you know, like literally living in a cornfield in a friggin' trailer with a mouse. And I mentioned I had four people working for me. They were going to close it down. They had one person there when I got there. And I said, I got to be able to hire people and to make loans. And, you know, ended up doing really well. They offered me a really big office. They were like, you know, you're a big success. I'm like, I don't like this business. I'm getting out of here. Sold everything. Sold this used French car I had that had no third gear. I remember I used to have to pop it from second to fourth gear. And I just went to New York. I had $2,000 in my pocket. It was 1985. And the first week I slept on the floor of a buddy of my sister's. And then I met these two, one woman that I had gone to high school with and her roommate, and they rented me a room, a bedroom. And I met Mike Rispoli, and Michael and I ended up becoming roommates, and we lived on 109th Street, 144 West 109th Street from 85 to 88. And I just was always in classes. You know, I started waitering and worked a door. I was a bartender. I was a cater waiter. You know, I did all the actor jobs and, you know, took classes and made sure that I was always in a class, you know, just trying to learn. Got into a 2-year Meisner program, and there was like movement and voice and diction and, you know, scene study. And I did a whole thing for 2 years, and it was, you know, gave me my foundation. And then, you know, I was just trying to hustle. I was hustling commercials and industrial movies, like training movies for companies, and learning about the camera and trying to get an agent, had a manager. The manager didn't really have any power to get me any, you know, play auditions or auditions for theater. But then I met an agent. I went to a casting director, wonderful casting director. She's still in the business, and she was casting a commercial, and I had just finished auditioning for her. And I said, I had heard in the lobby that you're auditioning for the Glass Menagerie that, at this regional theater in New Jersey at Fairleigh Dickinson.
Okay.
I think I'd be good as the gentleman caller, you know. And she, like, this is like after my audition, like between the time I finished and her going to the door with a room full of, she's behind schedule, and there's like, you know, 15 actors waiting to come in. And I'm like, I said, could I get an audition? Could you just give me a shot? And to her great credit, Judy Henderson, Judy looked at me, she looked me up and down. She goes, all right, I'll give you a shot. You know, my assistant will give you a time. And I got the gig and got me my equity card. And, you know, I started doing theater all over the country, you know, Ohio, Jersey, Massachusetts, you know, everywhere. And come back into town. That my whole thing was come back into town, book a few commercials so that the residuals pay for my health insurance and I can live. And then for the, like, you know, the $300, $400 of pay me a week to do theater, I can keep a roof over my head.
Yeah. Do you remember going back, like, some of the commercials? Were they like big brands or like local around here, just like tri-state area commercials?
Nah, they were national. I mean, I was the Stroh's beer guy for a while. I had this dog who would bury a beer truck, and what else? The dog ordered a side of beef, a poodle, and a case of Stroh's. When this was before Stroh's was, I think Stroh's doesn't exist anymore.
I know. I was going to say, I never heard of that before.
Yeah, but Stroh's was a big brand out of Milwaukee for a while. So I did that. I did Miller. I did, what was the big, I got a Mediquel. I did a Mediquel commercial that ran for a long time. And Red Lobster. I remember I did a Red Lobster commercial. And I remember that because they were laughing at me. They said, you know, you should spit the lobster legs. It was King Crab Claws. They said, you should spit that out because we're going to do probably 50 to 60 takes. And I looked at the guy and he started laughing. I said, man, I grew up near the Chesapeake Bay. We eat crab like, you know, like other people eat crackers. Like, I'm eating this stuff. Like, you know, you get to like the 24th take and you're like, okay, I'm spitting this stuff. You know, right?
Oh, that's great.
But, you know, when you do in the old days, and it's funny to say that now, but, you know, working in front of a camera, you know, I learned how to hit a mark. I learned how to walk and talk and chew gum, you know, in front of a camera. I learned lighting. I learned how to behave on a set. I learned the protocol on the set of what a first DP, you know, what a first AD does versus a second AD, you know, why you want to make friends with the, not necessarily the DP, but definitely with the camera guy or gal, and absolutely with the focus puller, because you always want to be in focus. And you learn, you know, you just, like, by doing it, I mean, I ended up doing, you know, including regional commercials, probably 50 commercials, and
oh, wow,
at least, and a couple, you know, I don't know, dozen or two dozen training films, and you just learn a lot. And then it helped me for, you know, when I got a break and got a movie of the week that took me out to got the lead in a movie of the week that took me to LA, and, you know, my career changed, you know, overnight. So then people were like, you know, you already know how to do this stuff pretty well, you know, you're not just a stage actor who doesn't know anything. So, you know, a lot of that's just from taking whatever comes in front of you and not being picky. I didn't have room to be picky, because, you know, I had friends in acting class who, like, mommy and daddy were paying their rent on the side, and that was not my case. I mean, I was on my own, man. So I was like, yeah, my parents don't have any money to sustain me. I got to hustle my own thing. So
I think that maybe that even helped you out even more, made you hungrier. And I think your background, you know, playing lacrosse, playing a team sport, especially at a high level. I don't know who the coach, I wouldn't know off the top of my head what the name of the John Hopkins coach was then. I'm sure he's a legend.
He is, actually. He's in the Coaches Hall of Fame. He's in the U.S. Lacrosse Hall of Fame. He still holds the highest winning percentage of any coach in the history of Division I. I mean, you know, when I left Hopkins, our record, when I was a senior, our record was like 61-4.
Wow.
You know, in 4 years, we lost like four games. You know, in 79, we were undefeated, you know, and so, you know, the thing that taught me is, you know, how to just keep your cool and keep your focus when you got thousands of people. Like, in those days, a big crowd was at the national championship game was 20,000, you know?
Yeah.
But even at a big rivalry with, like, Maryland, we could get 8,000 to 10,000 to 12,000, and, you know, they hated us and we hated them. And there was always all 5 years that I was there, there was always a fight with Maryland. We always had a fight. We always play them twice and we beat them every single time. And in my whole career there, we were 10-0 against the Terps, and we hated those motherfuckers. Yeah. They hated us, and, you know, we didn't care. You know, it's funny now when we bump into each other, when I see the guys I used to play against, we were like hugging each other and like, remember the days we were trying to punch each other's lights out, you know, like,
and I think that translated, you know, you're on the, like you said, when you're on the set, I think some people that might not have that sports background might not think about knowing what everyone's job is. Especially when you're on a field, you know what this guy does, what he's doing. So that's the way teams work. So that's why you're able to learn so much on the fly.
I just learned this word grok, G-R-O-K, when you grok things, when you like tie everything together, you just grokked it.
Yeah,
that is true. No, it is true, because I think the word grok is from Zen in the art of motorcycle maintenance or something like that, or one of those books. But
I think my wife has that book. True. I think you got that right.
It's true, because, you know, guys that you play with, if you're playing to win and you're playing for competitively for a championship, anybody steps out of line, everybody lets you know real quick. On a set, on any set, you got 100 people in a crew. You got 100 people, and everybody's got a critical job. And you're just, you know, and I was a role player. I mean, and that, in some ways, that's even more important, in the sense that I was an All-American in high school, and I knew what it was to be a star, because I was like the star guy on my senior year in high school. I was an All-American. I was an All-Metro player, All-County player, first team, you know, but then I go to college and the game is much faster, and I'm playing with dudes who, you know, I played with a half a dozen guys who were in the Hall of Fame, who were like on an elite athletic level. You know, there's a real difference between being able to play ball D1, like all these basketball players now. The guys on the bench, let me tell you something, those guys can all play.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But the guys who are the star players in those teams, they're at another level. They're just at another level. And everybody knows it. And that's, that's the great thing about sports, that is a true meritocracy. It doesn't matter the color of your skin, it doesn't matter your religion, it doesn't matter where you're from, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, you can either play ball or you can't.
Yeah.
And that did translate to sets, because, you know, and my father and his brothers are all former Marines, and the one thing they taught me was respect for everyone and everything that everyone does. And, you know, you don't walk around like your shit don't stink, and you don't walk around like you put your underwear on any different from anybody else. You walk around asking people, how can I help you? Can I do something for you? I mean, you know, like, thanks for, and you say thanks a lot, because it's a big machine. Any set is a big machine. And to make the machine work right, you don't need any fucking divas. And yeah. I don't like divas. I mean, I was laughing with a friend of mine. I did a Hallmark movie. I'm not going to say the actor because it doesn't matter anymore, and it wouldn't be right anyway. But anyway, yeah. This guy kept showing up late to the set, and he had a role that was bigger than mine. I mean, he had a starring role, and I finally like knocked on his door and went in, because the director was a writer director was a friend of mine who had actually fought for this guy, and I knew he had fought. Hallmark didn't want to hire this guy. He had a bit of reputation. He's a good actor, but he had a problem with the bottle, you know. So, you know, a guy opens his door and he goes, hey, what do you want? And he's a big guy. He's my size. You know, he's at least 6'2", 6'3". And I said, I got to come up and talk to you. And I come up, I close the door, and I said, you fucking ever show up late again on a set, I will fucking lay you out. Do you understand? And I said, you owe apology. You owe an apology to this whole crew and to my friend, you know, the director, I won't say his name, who fought for you. You know, and by the end of it, the guy's crying. He goes, I know, man, I'm sorry. And I'm like, I'm literally pounding my hand on his friggin' counter. And I said, don't you dare fucking apologize. You were warned the first time. Now you've done it twice. And we all sat around here for 3 hours. And by the way, now I got to come in on a Friday and shoot because they had to redo the schedule. And I just had to tell my wife that I had to cancel on a dinner that she had set up. And she's pissed at me. So now I'm pissed at you because there's this whole fucking domino effect. So, you know, just be a fucking human being and show up and be a pro, you know? And so the only reason I'm telling that story, and I'm not bragging at all, I'm just telling that story because like my whole life came into that moment, in the sense that every locker room I was ever in, everybody knows their job, everybody knows their role. And it did prepare me for any kind of ensemble work. And I've always loved it when a group of people, a team, can either perform at a high level and succeed on an athletic field, or on a stage, or in front of on a sound stage, or in front of cameras. That there's a kind of a high that I get when you kind of go, wow, that was a pretty good day. That was a good day. Everybody, that was cool. And it's a well-written story, and it'll be, or it's really funny, and we really nailed some jokes, and we really got it, you know?
Yeah. Like
when I worked on Almost Perfect, we knew if the camera guys and gals were laughing, because they've seen everything. They're almost jaundiced. They're so leathery, like they, nothing makes them laugh. But the writing on that show was so friggin' good.
Yeah.
And when we started chuckling, we were like, okay, we got something here, you know?
So let's talk about that. And then we could just go back to other things. Sure. So do you remember, I'm sure you remember that. That was like a big deal. Landing as a regular role.
Yeah. That was my first series regular. They couldn't find the guy. I know they had read like 50, 60 guys. They had read guys like, and he was unknown at the time, but I know they had read John Slattery, and they'd read some big name guys, and I was put on tape in New York in those days when it was tape, and I was in a play, and the only day I could fly out, and I had to do it secretly because we had already been warned, because one of the people in our play, Dylan Baker, had been hired by Murder One, and he had to leave the play, and that director blew up and he ripped the whole cast. He said, nobody leaves this play because we're 3 weeks in, I can't replace anybody. Well, technically, under equity rules, you can give your notice, because if you are given a higher paying job, you're allowed to leave because you're a freelance artist. And so I flew out secretly on a Monday. I read for the writers. Then we all got in cars. Nancy Travis was doing a movie literally up on Mulholland Drive shooting an exterior. We go up and we all cram into this, you know, it wasn't a tiny trailer. She was becoming a big star then. And it was a pretty good sized trailer, but you know, there's like 10 people crammed inside of her trailer watching the two of us read. And then they were like, okay, that went well. Let's go over to CBS. Now I had landed at 10 in the morning, and they had, and they, you know, we, I read for them. They bought me lunch. Then we went to see Nancy. Then we did that. And then they gave me like an hour or 2 hours off. Then at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I read at CBS for the president of the network and a whole, you know, room full of people. And they asked me to wait outside, and then they came out. The writers came out. They dismissed the other actors, and I thought I was, you know, going to leave. I didn't know why they weren't telling me to leave too. I had a plane to catch. I had to catch a red eye to get back in time for the Tuesday show. And I we were in previews, and I get back, and the president says, he shakes my hand. He goes, I look forward to seeing you and Nancy for many years doing this. And he leaves, and Peter Tortorici, and I it was before Moonves, and I looked at Ken Levine and David Isaacs, who were two of the writers, and Robin Schiff, who created it. And I said, what does he mean? He looks forward. And Ken was like, you just got the job, dummy. And I said, well, he didn't say you got the job. He just said, I look forward to it. It's like code.
Yeah.
So we shot the, I had to leave the play, and there was a lot of Hazara, and guy director was screaming at me and all this stuff. And I was like, man, I'm playing four little roles. You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And went out, and the pilot went really well, and the audience was roaring, and we were like, wow, this is like, and Nancy, I to this day, I always say she's like a Lucy Arnaz, you know, she'll do any kind of physical comedy. You know, she used to like do pratfalls, and, you know, she'll tumble over stuff, and she was game for anything. And she just glowed. I mean, she was beautiful and funny and smart and had real great instincts about script. And they picked us up, and, you know, and then that first season we did really well. And CBS was in the toilet. They were number four in those days. And I think we were number out of 100. In those days, there was only 100 shows on. It was like, we were number 30, 31, 32, 28, 29, right around number 30 all the time. And we were the highest rated new show on CBS, and literally the only pilot that got picked up that was actually got a back end and then got a second season order. And so it was amazing. But then Tortorici got fired. Moonves came in, and he said, if you want that second season, I want her to date other guys and get rid of the guy. He was no doubt in my mind. That was the days when Sybil Shepherd had her show called Sybil. And it was in season five and it was dying and going to go off the air. And she was a blonde who dated a lot of different guys. And so Moonves thought it was a great idea, or else he was in love with Nancy, who knows these days with what's happened with him, you know, that he just wanted her to be single. And, yeah. You know, and Ken and Robin and David, like, they just like looked at him and said, that's not the show we created. Like, we created Adam's Rip. We created Hepburn and Tracy and Hepburn. This is like a modern day Tracy and Hepburn. We don't know what to do. And he said, well, you know, she'll date different guys. And he said, and they were like, that's not the show. And he goes, well, what's going to happen to them? Are they going to get married? And they said, well, maybe eventually. But, you know, it was funny because Helen Hunt and Paul Reiser were having a great success with their show. And I was like, what is he talking about? Like, Reiser and Hunt are married, and millions of people are tuning in every week to laugh at them. What? So I knew it was bullshit, and everybody else knew it was bullshit. He just didn't. What really happens is when you come in as president of a network, you actually kill all the bastard children, so that nobody can say, well, it was your predecessor who greenlit that show.
Yeah.
That's why it's a success. You just kill whatever's left over, so that it's all on you and you're the hero and all that shit.
That happens in everything, even in like in sports. A new GM, sure. Like, I'm a Giants fan. The new GM comes in, I'm going to get rid of every guy the previous guy got, even if it's the best player.
That's right. OBJ.
Yeah, I know.
OBJ, man. Like, really?
I know.
You didn't really get much for him, huh?
It all depends on if they do something with the picks. But so I watched that, the Almost Perfect. Like, I think most of them are on YouTube, and I watched the pilot today.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was really funny. I enjoyed it.
Good.
Yeah. You seem really comfortable, like the way that you and her work together, especially now that, you know, knowing your background and what you're doing, like, to prepare for this. Yeah, it was awesome. And you know what's really funny? I never saw the person that was the voice of Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
And it's so weird hearing Chip Zion talk.
That's all. Did you see that movie? Did you see that movie?
I never saw that movie.
But, oh, okay.
But everybody used to tease Chip about Howard the Duck. I love Chip. I love Chip. I love them all. I love them.
Yeah.
Matt's gotten a big career, and I loved Clennon, and they were really funny guys. And I got to tell you, just for fun, when the writers really got into their groove, believe me, there's even funnier episodes on YouTube than that pilot. I mean, really fun. There's an episode where she takes me to some Zen retreat in the high desert where we can't eat or we can't speak, and it's just fucking hysterical. And the couple, and you're not even supposed to touch. And like the couple next door is like, you know, we're like jumping around in our sleeping bags because it's freezing. It's the high desert. Yeah. So you're freezing. And I'm like, I can hear them in there. They're eating McDonald's, you know, it's like, it's hysterical stuff. And then I said, now they're boffing or whatever I was saying, boinking, you know, it's like, you know, and you know, Mike's character is like, I want to go home and get a Philly cheesesteak for God's sake. You know, and she's like, no, Mike, we have to change our lives. And it's just classic, like Hepburn Tracy stuff of like the girl going, no, come on, we can do this. It'll make us better human beings. And the guy's like, will you give me a hamburger for God's sake? You know, so it's funny.
And it was cool. That first episode was directed by Andy Ackerman, who's like a legend.
Yeah, Ackerman.
That guy's done so many. Like, it's like you watch Seinfeld, you see him on Seinfeld. He directed Curb, you know, a ton of shows.
Well, the reason, listen, first of all, Andy's a great guy.
Yeah.
Andy's got like 4 or 5 kids. You've never met a more regular guy in his life. He grew up on the beach in California. He's just a regular, humble beach guy. He's like a surfer dude.
Yeah.
Really smart. He knows how to fix scripts. He knows how to get humor out of a moment that doesn't, like, is not really funny yet. But he sees the way into the humor. And that's why everybody uses him. I mean, that's why he and a handful of other directors are truly the gold standard in television comedy.
Yeah.
And you know, and he also has this like totally cool, laid back, doesn't ever yell, comes over, might whisper something in your ear, kind of cool dude. And he's happy. He's always smiling, Andy. And I got to do a guest star on New Adventures of Old Christine. And my wife, Jordan, played Mrs. Belt. So she did like half a dozen episodes of that.
Oh, wow.
And I used to go watch her during her filming, and Ackerman did all these things. So, I mean, I used to see Andy a lot, and he's just a great dude. I mean, he deserves everything he gets because he's truly that talented.
I know he did a lot of Frasier. Did he do the episode that you were on?
No. You'll laugh about this, though, but you know who did? Ken Levine, who was one of the writer, executive producers, creators of Almost Perfect.
Oh, wow.
He segued into directing, and he directed that episode, Roz and the Schnoz.
Oh, look at that. Funny? I never watched Frasier growing up. I never watched it. So it's on Netflix now, and I said to my wife, because she said she used to watch it, and I mentioned, I was like, oh, you know, guy Kevin I'm interviewing, he was in Roz and the Schnoz. And she's like, oh, I remember that. So I watched that clip, and then I started watching it, and that show right from the – it's rare for these shows – right from jump, right in the first episode, phenomenal.
Well,
the timing is just great.
We finished that. They did over 200 episodes.
Yeah, it's years wild.
And David and Kelsey and John Mahoney, they all told us. They said when we finished that episode, they just turned to us. Jordan and I know David a little bit. I mean, well, whenever we see him in New York, we sit there and chat with him because, you know, we're just, you know, he's very sweet and very nice guy and a smart guy. And he always says to us, he goes, that was truly one of the 5 funniest of the 200 we did. He goes, that episode was unbelievable. People were literally peeing their pants in the stands. They were laughing so hard. And you can look, if you look really closely, he can't say keep a straight face. And my wife, when he says, oh, what kind of dogs do you have? And she says, we have 2 giant schnauzers. I mean, you know, 2 years after that episode, Kelsey was an executive producer on some failed pilot that ultimately failed. But I was coming in to read for him in his office at Paramount. And I come in the door. I don't know who this guy, I mean, you know, I worked with him that one time. I mean, I didn't ever bump into him anywhere. So I hadn't seen him in 2 years. I walk in the door and I'm 2 feet in the door and he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, you're the one with the wife who couldn't keep the straight face." I said, "Yeah, that's me." And again, he like looked at my nose at the table read and he went, "They really don't have to do much work, do they?" And I said, "No, they don't, Kelsey." I said, "My nose is right in the room. My nose is usually the first thing in any room. So yeah. Okay, what are you going to do?"
How long, do you remember how long it took to do that shoot? Like, was there a lot of retakes because they were just losing it?
No, we did the typical thing that you do in a half hour. You rehearse for 4 days.
Oh, awesome.
And then you do it in front of two live audiences. They have, maybe that one was actually one live audience. Like in the days, like the first thing I ever did, the first guest star I ever did was the Cosby Show. And you would do it at 4 o'clock from 4 to 5:30, 6. You would have a dinner break. And then a different audience would come in and you would do it again from 7:30 to whenever, because they would even send the audience home from the second one and you would do what's called punch up, you know, where they would just, the writers would throw different lines at you and they would do you a close up and you know, cause they're going to test those lines to see which one gets the biggest laugh. And then like with Almost Perfect and same with Frasier, I think we would just do one. Then we keep the one audience and then at 11, you know, by 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, you send them home and you do punch up for, you know, the shows that are not doing well, will do punch up till 2-3 in the morning because they're just scrambling. But I was, you know, knock wood, both Almost Perfect and Frasier, you'd be done by 11:30 because those men and women really knew what they were doing, those writers, and you knew you had it. But Levine ended up directing that. So it was kind of like it was a small world there for a while. And then Ken got out of the business and he was a baseball announcer. He was the radio guy for Seattle and San Diego. And
oh, wow.
One season for Baltimore and then he LA Dodgers. And David Isaacs ended up teaching, I think, at UCLA, teaching comedy writing. And Robin Schiff, I think, still is in the business and still trying to produce. But it was sad because Ken and David told me this story. I bumped into him years later and we had a lunch together and they said, we're going to tell you a story. It won't mean anything to you because 2 years after the show was canceled, the second season, we had to get rid of, you know, the first episode of the second season, they got rid of me. And then they had only shot 7 before it was canceled. And they only aired 3 in the second season because the ratings went in the toilet. And yeah. Everybody knew they would because everybody was tuning in to watch the chemistry between me and Nancy. You know, I mean, that was the show, really, the heart and soul of the show.
Oh, yeah.
And he said Levine and Isaacs were a writing team. They had met each other in the Army, and they used to say, you know, we've known each other, and we've been writing partners longer than we've been married to our wives. And they go into this executive room at CBS, and Moonves is sitting at the other end, and the whole room is empty, and he's got lunch ordered for him. He said, we were no sooner in the door walking over to the table, and he's like, "Almost Perfect, the worst decision I ever made." And Levine said he just wanted to strangle him. He was like, you know, like, "Fuck you, pal." You know, that's all you got to say for killing a great show? Because, you know, as Ken said to me and David too, they said, what's arrogant and funny about these presidents of these networks is they think that you can just snap your fingers and come up with a great idea. They have no idea that David and I had waited a lifetime. They had done their training on MASH. They had ended up running Cheers. They worked on Cheers for 4 years and season the fourth year they were there, they ran the writer's room. They worked their way up. They slogged their way up. They had a couple other failed pilots. And Ken said to me, you know, through tears in his eyes, he said, "The greatest idea we ever had was Almost Perfect and this fucking moron killed it." You know? Damn. So, you know, but that's no different from, you know, there have been a lot of stupid decisions in Hollywood. And
yeah.
God knows Almost Perfect is just one of many good ideas that somebody didn't have the balls to finish on, you know, whatever.
And I'm sure there's some other things in between movie roles and TV shows. But then, right after that, you were in Home Alone 3.
Yeah. This is a weird thing. I know I was on some list and I had never worked over at Fox and I was quite literally, I don't think I auditioned. It was just,
really?
It was a straight offer. And But I knew where I was because I was on the other side of the world. I was in Bhutan. I had done a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie with a very unknown Naomi Watts.
Wow.
And James Earl Jones and Ellen Burstyn called Timepiece. And Ellen had told me while we were filming in North Carolina, she said, I'm going to Bhutan with Dr. Robert Thurman, Uma Thurman's dad. He's an amazing, he speaks Tibetan, he speaks six languages, he's a professor at Columbia, and he's an amazing, like, incredible savant. You know, he can tell you everything about Tibet and Bhutan, and, you know, and he's taken a group of 16 people. Well, I said, well, I'm going on that trip. And she's like, it's been sold out for 2 years. And I called the guy who's the head of the trip, some company in San Francisco, I remember. And I said, man, I'll sleep on the ground. I'm like, I'll ride on top of the bus. I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, and I kept calling him every other day. And he's like, I'm telling you, the thing's sold out. And then somebody got sick. And he said, you've been so, you know, such a pest. I'm going to let you come. And I was in Bhutan and I literally got a cable in those days when you could get like a, you know, like literally like a cable came through that said, you need to call your agent in LA. And I was laughing going, how the frig did they find me in Bhutan? Man, that's like crazy. And they, and Ellen had wanted me, she was going on, I'll never forget. She was going on to Cambodia because to see Angkor Wat, to see the hidden city. And then she was going to Bali and she goes, just, you know, just tag along with me. She goes, I'll show you. We're going to, you know, I got things set up and you'll see things you'll never forget for the rest of your life. And I get this call. You have to come back like immediately and you need to fly into LA and you will be in LA for less than 24 hours. And I'm going to fly you directly to Chicago and you're going to start filming. So in my head, I kind of went either somebody dropped out or they couldn't sign someone and they couldn't close the money on someone. And I, as most actors are, I was like, I'm somewhere down the list. They went, oh, Kilner, he'll take that. He'll take the money. And, but I was flattered because I loved the original Home Alones. And when I read it, I thought it was actually a really funny concept. And I remember that I thought that Home Alone 2 kind of sucked.
Yeah.
I still think that the original is the best one. But I thought ours was number two. I thought ours was really funny and, and worked. You know, I met all those guys. Those were all New York actors who did the, including Marion Seldes, who did the Cranky Neighbor, but also, I'm forgetting her name. Rasha Draco. No, not Rasha. What was the guy who was the leader of the international?
Oh, yeah. I forget his name.
He you see him in movies all day. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
And I hung out with him and David, what's his name, is married to Cyndi Lauper. You know, he was fantastically funny. And I kept saying to him, I want to be one of your roles. I want my hair burned and singed. And, you know, I want to fall into a bucket of goo. I think that would be fun. But I was just happy to be the dad, you know, and even though the dad's kind of not there.
Now, was John Hughes involved in it? Like, was he on set the whole time?
He was not on set the whole time.
Okay.
You know, he did make an appearance and, and he had approval. Obviously he had approval over everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, the vast majority of the time he wasn't there and, he was just a big producer on it, I think, mostly.
Yeah. I think the reason why I really always enjoyed the third one was the first one, like you said, it's the original story. This is like, well, you asked me in the beginning, like, what's the whole like concept of this project about? The second movie, it was basically the same thing. Like, you had these two grown, again, it's a comedy film, but you have these two grown men that have this vendetta against a kid. And it just so happens to be in New York this time, you know, throwing Donald Trump and all that, and blah, blah, blah. It's the same thing, Central Park. But in the third one, it was essentially with John Hughes writing it again. You don't see that too often, like somebody that's continually there. Yeah. And boom, it like took it up a notch. It wasn't just two little guys that are just robbing people for jewelry. It was like a big deal.
Yeah, no, he did. And you know, I feel really bad about John's early demise and his death because I think he was really good at what he did. I mean, people, it's hard to contextualize things now, but I mean, he was the ruler of family comedy for a while.
Oh, yeah.
He was the peak of the friggin' mountain, man. And everything from Pretty in Pink to, like, you know, he knew the teen movies, The Breakfast Club, all that stuff, man. He was like, and he just knew funny, and but more importantly, I thought he did funny along with actually reached into like real relationship about the way teenagers deal with each other and, you know, families deal with each other in a fun way. So, you know, it's just sort of heartbreaking. He's still not with us. And, he deserves every accolade or kudo that he gets, because he was really great.
Huge. Yeah. Every movie he nails just what you're watching and gets you emotion. Like you're watching a comedy to kind of escape and laugh. And then you had the opportunity, your on set wife was from 16 Candles.
I know. I mean, and she, you know, she was great. I mean, she, first of all, she's a great actress.
Yeah.
You know, and she's just a good person. This is basically, you know, she's more the lead than I was. Cause I forget, I was like in an airport snowed in somewhere or something like
that.
But it was, you know, it was a good group and we all got along. And I remember it was a bitterly, we shot from, got there in late November and we finished, or I finished in February. I think they may have finished the first week of March, and it was a, you know, 3-month, 4-month shoot. And it was just like, ugh, freezing freaking cold. I remember Jordan and I, we weren't married at the time. We tried to go out of our hotel room in downtown Chicago, and I'm not kidding you. We tried to walk 2 blocks to a steakhouse. We were bent over at a 45 degree angle. The wind was blowing so hard and it was so cold. The tears were streaming out of our eyes. And I just looked at her and I said, you know, I remember saying to her inside the hotel room, our windows had like frozen like an ice cube. So you couldn't see out. Like it was literally like, oh my God, it's so cold that the wind, there's frost on a hotel windows, you know, that don't even open. And I remember saying to her, it was so painful. I said, you want to go back and order room service? And she's like, yes, let's go back.
So when you're, this is great. It's great that you brought that up. So when you are signing up for a movie and they say, you know, your agent says, hey, you're going to be in this, is there like a set amount of days that your contract's for, or you're in it for the long haul? Like no matter as long as it takes.
Haviland Morris. I couldn't
remember. Haviland. Yeah. Okay.
Haviland. In the case of having a lead in a movie like that with a studio budget behind it, they have you for the duration. They will negotiate saying, you know, the total of days you're going to shoot, are they going to be these days? But everything is subject because schedules change all the time. People get sick, people get hurt. They have to flip the whole schedule. So you have to be available, but they'll say like, you know, and I'm no expert. I mean, you should talk to a professional agent about this, but they'll say like, shoot is 3 months. Kevin will be working approximately 12 to 14 days. We want to pay him blah, blah, blah. Those 12 to 14 days will happen over the course of, can happen anytime during the shoot, but will likely happen over the course of 3 or 4 weeks of the 12 weeks. You know what I mean? Type of, that's with a studio picture. With the indie film, most of the time, my experience is most indie films you're shooting in 4 to 5 weeks. You can sometimes shoot an indie film in 3 weeks. And you're really, I mean, man, you're working like lightning. You work like as fast as television. And then they just have you for the whole time. And, you know, I've done every contract you can imagine. I've fallen in love with scripts and done waiver. I've done ultra low budget. I've done low budget. I've done, you know, modified low budget. I think they're SAG-AFTRA has 4 independent film contracts, and, you know, they created those because they wanted young filmmakers to, and it was a smart idea, you know, to help them make their movies. But, you know, you work for an independent film, you can be working for, I've worked for as little as $125 a day. I did a waiver film where I just did it. I volunteered. Sometimes you only get $500 a week on an indie film. You know, it's like working on stage.
Yeah.
And oftentimes in any indie film, if you see me, whatever clothes you see me in, that's out of my friggin' closet. And that's most actors, you know, because they don't even have a budget for wardrobe. So they're just saying, you know, this is how I dress. Can you bring half your closet and we'll choose a few things. And, you know, it's always a passion project for me. It's with an independent film where there's no real money, I just say to myself, I really like this script. I like this director. I'd like to do this.
That's awesome.
So you just make it happen. And it's like similar like to doing 99 seat waiver theater in LA where, you know, you're going out and finding your own props and you're using your own wardrobe and, you know, everybody knows that they're just doing it because they love storytelling.
Yeah.
And it's like anything else in life. You know, either if you really love it, you know, you'd almost don't tell anybody, but you'd almost do it for next to nothing. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
We love doing, and I love storytelling. And I used to play this game with myself. Like if I was in a horrible accident and my face went through the windshield, and I looked like Zipperhead the rest of my life. What would I do? And I thought, you know, I would still be in the storytelling business. I'd become a producer, or a writer, or, you know, maybe I'd become a camera operator. I don't know. I mean, I like being in the storytelling business. So.
That's great. It's funny you say that. I just watched an interview about with Michael Jordan early on. It must have been just before the first three-peat. He was getting interviewed about basketball. And I can't even imagine what they were getting paid around that time towards, you know, what like Jordan would be worth today. It'd be like unbelievable money-wise. But he was talking about, I play the game not for the money. He's like, even if I didn't get paid, I would still be playing basketball. And he just looks so serious. And if you look the way he played, he did that. He gave it all, no matter what.
Well, I say this to young actors all the time, and you know, because there's a story I tell all the time whenever I'm getting more and more into teaching, and my wife is too.
Yeah, cool.
When I teach young actors, I just say to them, you know, my Meisner class, which was a commitment for 2 years, and there were only 16 of us. And, you know, you had to be interviewed, and, you know, she had to offer you a position. And you knew that when you committed, you knew you were committing for 2 years. And it was three times a week and 4 hour classes. And, you know, you show up. If you don't show up, they ask you to leave. Well, the first night, Catherine Gately, who's now Professor Catherine Gately, she said, turned to us. She said, I want you to look at everybody and look on either side of you. Look at the person to your left. Look at the person to your right. Look behind you. Look at everyone. In 5 years, half of you won't be acting, and that'll be okay because the study of acting is the study of what it means to be a human being, so you'll be better human beings. So whatever it is you're meant to do in this world and in this life, you'll just be better at it. In 10 years, if I'm really lucky, the 16 will still be doing it. Two of you will have support jobs full time. And if I'm really, really lucky, one of the 16 will be making a living at it. And I'm here to tell you, it's my understanding from my class, I'm the only one who made a living at it. And she was 100% accurate. And I think it's good that way in the sense that, you know, and I'm not saying because it's just, sometimes you find the thing you're meant to do. That's where I'm getting back to the Michael Jordan thing.
Yeah.
You find that thing where you're supposed to do that, you know, you do it. You just do it. You find a way to do it. And the people that end up staying in something 30, 40, 50 years, their lifetime, you know, I've started my 35th year. I just finished 34 years in February. I mean, to think that I've spent my whole life as a professional actor, it's mind-boggling. I mean, I know the statistics because I served 4 years in the National Boardroom at SAG, and that, you know, just having a career this long where I've done nothing but act puts me in the top 1%, 2%. And that's humbling because there's 125,000 people that hold a SAG after card. And only about 12, which is a big, you know, like don't tell people this, but really only 12 to 14 make a living at it. That's 12 to 14,000 people in the entire 330 million people in this country who make a living at it. And I'm here to tell you, every year is a nail biter. Every year it's hard. And every year you got like, I don't know how we're going to pay that bill. But I'm too old to do anything else now. And more importantly, I still love storytelling too much. And it is what it is. And I'm sure that's what that look you saw in Jordan's eye, I'm sure that was all encompassed in that look.
Oh, yeah.
I know it was, you know, and it's no different that when, you know, like I, for some weird reason, I'm kind of like, I admire people that blow glass, like glass blowers, like
yeah,
and stuff. I look at those dudes like, you're not making a shitload of money, but man, the beauty that they make, and you have to be deeply into it. That stuff, you can get severely burned. I mean, it's hard work, you know. You don't do that unless you have a passion for it. Give me a break. You know, I'm going to play around at blowing glass. I don't think so, you know.
We stopped at one of those places one time. We were coming back from getting our marriage license, and we got married in Canada. So on our way back, we stopped at one of those places, and we were in the front row, and we were probably still a good like 20, 25 feet from the people. And you feel the heat on your face. So
yeah,
they're.
Yeah. But you know, like anything else in life, it's funny. We in America, we always focus on our stars and whatever they are. It's like now the NCAA tournament's going on, and we're focused on those, you know, coaches who make seven figures.
I know.
But you know, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of coaches making, you know, 60, 50, 40, 70,000 a year coaching in Division III, and you know, and don't tell me they're doing it just because it's a job. I mean, they do it because they love it. You know, I mean. You either got it or you don't. You either have a passion for it or you don't.
Yeah.
You just got to try on air.
Because people will find out, especially players or whatever you're doing, people will find out that you're not there for the real reasons, and then you'll be out pretty quick.
Well, most importantly, if you're being honest with yourself, you'll find out first.
Oh, yeah.
You can't really fool yourself. Yeah. I know at least three times in my career where I literally went, I was about 10 years in the first time, and I went up to Columbia. I was living in New York. I went up to Columbia University, and I got the master's packet for filling out all the application for getting a master's degree in English literature, because I was like, I'm going to go be a teacher because I've plateaued and I don't want to just be a guest star on TV shows, and this sucks, and I hate being on the road as much as I am in regional theater. I mean, I love the plays, but you know, I'm never sleeping in my own bed, and I'm a single guy and I can't seem to find, you know, I mean, I was dating different women, but you know, like everybody wants you to be established. And I was like, ah. So yeah, there are those times when I, you know, I doubted and, you know, thought, you know, maybe I would be better. My mom was a teacher and she always thought I'd be a good teacher. You know, maybe I should be teaching, you know, it's like, that's human, you know, but every time I tried to get out, I got a bit of a break. I caught a little break. Put a little wind in my sails, and then it just went on. And now I'm too old to do anything else.
And so, now you're 25 years ago from that moment, you're teaching.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. It's interesting to be teaching, you know, acting. And but I also think that whatever it is you do, if you do it for over a quarter of a century and you have some wisdom or knowledge, or not even the wisdom or not, let's just say you have experience. I think I feel like it's almost your duty to pass that experience on to younger people. I mean, you know, why would you just keep that to yourself? Like, you know, help them out, help them so they don't make the same dumb mistakes that I made, you know?
No, that makes a lot of sense. We have a newborn daughter and I think about that all the time. Like all these things that my parents could have said, hey, don't do this or pay attention to this and all this. Oh, they made those mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. Congrats on your daughter. That's great. Thank
you. Yeah.
That's great.
So yeah, a few more things, and thanks so much for taking the time.
Not at all.
So that scene in American Pie 2.
Okay.
That is like such a classic, and you're on air for, I don't know exactly how many seconds, but it is it's such a great scene.
Okay, so there's a funny story to that.
All right.
So J.B. Rogers had been the assistant. He was the first AD, actually he was the first AD on two television movies of the week that I had done. And JB's a great guy. He's just a down to earth guy too. You know, he's just like, let's go have a beer kind of guy, which is my kind of guy, you know. He called me up and he said, Kev, I caught a break. I'm directing American Pie 2. And I said, that's great, man. Congrats. And he says, listen, he goes, I'm a little embarrassed. I wish I could be, you know, but it's like teenagers. There's no real role for you, but there's a role for a dad. And all it says literally is goofy dad barbecuing in the backyard. And he said, I literally can only, they only have money, enough money for a day rate. And I just said, JB, I'm in, man. What do you want? He goes, it's not even really written. You'd have to improvise it. And I go, that's fine. We'll figure something out. That's cool. And we did it on, I'll never forget, we did it on a Saturday. And, you know, he said to me, he goes, look, you're listening to these two women who are like, these guys, they're going to make them strip. And, you know, and it's, and so I said, well, you know, what if he's getting off? And JP's like, he goes, okay, Cap. He goes, yeah, I get it. He goes, how far you want to go with this? And he goes, I can't have you with your hand down your pants. I said, no, I'm not talking that. I said, he just should be like getting, like, I'll make him like kind of like he's a square dude who like gets as aroused as the guys are by being, you know, like, you know. And so we just tried some stuff, you know, and the whole thing, like, we, you know, and we were literally done within 3 or 4 hours. It didn't even take the whole, you know, it was like literally they had to move on. It might've even been 2 hours. I forget. And he was very happy. He said, that is funny. He goes, I was like, you sure? Because I always think, you know, I'd rather do another 2 or 3 takes. And, you know, and he was like, no, I got it. We don't have to do anything more. I'm telling you right now, Kev, it's fine. They paid me, I'll never forget, they paid me $750, $850 for the day. Well, the movie made like $220 million. I don't even know what it made. It definitely went over 200.
Oh, yeah.
And in those days, I mean, today that would be like $400 million, yeah, right? I have made probably somewhere in the range of $20,000 to $30,000 off that movie for working 3 hours and improvising a scene that really wasn't even on the page. And that is like the best. As I said to my wife, there's never been a better job in my life than being in American Pie 2.
Because wow.
I have more people, more kids who now are young adults who come up to me and go, that fucking scene makes me laugh so hard.
Yeah. Now that part's awesome.
Yeah. It was just fun. It was just a goof. Man, it was a goof. And that's like catching lightning in a bottle too. And JB was great. And I was grateful for him for, you know, and he was like, no, man, you were always a great guy to work with. And, you know, because I knew you could come up with something. So it was cool.
That was cool that you're able to come up with it. And then it was that successful. So not only did you play the role.
But that's the thing. Believe me, I'm only going to emphasize this because you don't know what's going to happen. So that's why I was saying to him, can I do 2 or 3 more takes? Because I wasn't quite fully certain of what I had given him.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, the pecking order on a set is the director's the boss. And if the director says I'm happy and we got to move on, you don't fight it too much because he's the boss, she's the boss, whatever. Yeah. And but it wasn't until it came out, until you see how it's edited and cut together. Like, I think there's you see me and with the kids and then it cuts away to them and then it cuts back to me. And his edits were so tight and sharp that it would build and, you know, it got, you could see it coming. And you're like, oh my God, this is funny. You know? And so that's why everybody laughs so hard. So that, you know, but if you get a shitty editor or, you know, director didn't quite know what he or she wanted and didn't quite really get it, then you don't know. Then it doesn't become a success. Then you kind of go, we missed that opportunity. And I've done lots of films where I felt like, you know, you left and you went, I should have thought of that other thing. That would have made that scene pop. Or yeah. I should have, like, if you're improvising a line, especially like in the world of comedy, they'll say, can you give it a button? And you know, you try and come up with lines, but like technically, I mean, I'm not a writer. I have a bit of a goofy head, so I can think of funny stuff at times, but there's times I've definitely not come up with the funniest thing idea, and it sort of is languished and didn't really quite work. So you don't always hit a home run, but I think in American Pie 2, it just happened to work perfectly. So
yeah, when you're just holding, because you start off grilling and then it gets picked up by those walkie talkies and you're just like on that table by yourself and you're like, I'm not hungry.
Yeah. Leave me alone.
Yeah. That's so great.
You take care of the kids. we did one take. I'll never forget. We did one take. And I think Jimmy, and I don't know if it ended up in the movie. It's been so long since I've seen it, where I was like taking the phone and like rubbing my nipple with it. And JP was like, Kevin, what are you? I said, well, I said, you're laughing. And he goes, yeah, I'm laughing, but it's weird. And I said, yeah, okay, it's a little too, you know. So I tried all sorts of stuff. And, you know, whatever ended up on the screen is what he chose. But, you know, we tried lots of things.
So. That's awesome. All right. So I have 3 more questions.
Yeah, sure.
And then I'll let you go.
Big time.
So over the years, what was because you had the opportunity to be on a lot of have some guest roles.
Yep.
Obviously, we talked about Frasier. You're on Cosby Show. Is there any other ones that when you were on it, you were kind of, I don't know, starstruck and you're like, wow, I'm really doing this? Like you're on Murder, She Wrote, which was like a classic show that ran forever.
I don't think I've ever been more humble. It's funny you bring that up, because on Murder, She Wrote, I was humbled because Angela asked for me to come back. I had done a guest star in the prior season.
Oh, wow.
Totally different role. And when my agent called and said, you know, she'd like you to come back and do a different role, I said, really? Because aren't audiences going to remember me? And he said, no, Angela loves you. She likes you a lot. She'd love you. She liked your energy on the set. And, you know, and I thanked her profusely, because I'm humbled by that. You know,
like, yeah.
I still think of myself as just being a big goof. So, you know, that's just really nice. The Closer, you know, that guest star was, that was hard. That was a, you know, my son in that had a cancer, and the kid, I remember, you know, working with that group, and Kira Sedgwick is just such a phenomenal actor. And she was up for the Emmy every year. She's a fantastic actor.
Yeah.
And she was incredibly generous and complimentary in her words to me. And so was the director and executive producer. You know, it was a tough role, and was with a lot of really, you know, great actors, you know, on that. So I loved doing that one. You know, I was amazed at the success of, you know, of House of Cards, and I was grateful to do that role. It was a disappointment to me. I had read three times for the president and twice for the role I ended up getting. And, you know, I wish because I knew the president. I knew the president would, you know, go into season two. So I knew my character might disappear, which he did, and I think he reappeared. I think it was in the last episode of season three. But you know, to work with a director of that caliber, I mean, he's off the charts, you know. And it was a tense set, you know. Spacey was a perfectionist, and you know, he didn't make the set wasn't necessarily happy. It was just a functionary kind of like professional do things. Everybody was very, very tense, because it was, again, this is where context is really, really important. You know, this is $100 million gamble by a very unknown Netflix at the time.
Yeah.
But that room, that table read, all those actors, you know, those actors are all like actors from New York theater, and great actors, like really in, you know, in small supporting roles, but you know, every single actor, I mean, people like Reed Birney and you know, people like, you know, Michael Kelly was just blowing up then, and Jane Atkinson's a great, great stage actor. You know, Mahershala Ali was in that. I met Mahershala then. I mean, now he's become a superstar.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like Boris MacGyver. I'm looking at some of these guys now because I'm forgetting who was in it. Oh God, Larry Pine is a well-known New York actor. Sakina Jaffrey. Sakina blew up. I mean, Sakina became huge. Constance Zimmer. I mean, Constance.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these are like top shelf actors, you know, and so, you know, it was an honor to do that show. And, you know, Fincher was and Fincher still is, he's a perfectionist, you know, he's just a perfectionist.
Yeah.
Well, that was cool, you know, in a different way, because the writing was so good that we all knew it was going to be really good. And I remember sitting in Lincoln Center at the red carpet night where they did the first two episodes as a 2-hour movie. And you could hear, you know, people were roaring and standing up and cheering, and, you know, at the end. And we knew we had something, you know, or I knew they had something, I should say. You know, I knew I wasn't probably going to be part of it, but whatever. That was cool. That's
great. Really,
trying to think of... it's weird over a long career to think of like things that stick out. It's like, there's, little things, like even on junk, what I call junk TV. I mean, I did an episode of a series where I got to see the great Jonathan Winters at work.
Oh, wow.
You know, and share, and I didn't have any scenes with Jonathan, but we were on stage at the same time. And I was in awe of him. I mean, I watched him during a rehearsal have everybody crying. They were laughing so hard where he just did improvisation for over 30 minutes, wow. 40 minutes. And you know, someone who's that such a huge superstar. Trying to think of who else has really stuck in my brain.
Well, you worked with Scarlett Johansson when she was really young.
Yeah, Scarlett was 14.
I know.
And she'd just done Manny and Mo, which is a guy which had was going to Sundance. I think it went to Sundance, and she got really noticed by doing Manny and Mo, but this was the thing. And I remember she was there with her mom, and you know, she was just like, she had those like lips, and she already had this like face where you were just like, oh my God, this girl's like, I remember saying to her mother, I hope you have a baseball bat with a big nail in it because you're going to have to beat him off. You know, like she's a really pretty girl. And she was very sweet and very, 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 you know, just down to friggin' earth, you know. Yeah. There was nothing, there was no attitude, and she's all about the work. And she's still, from what I hear, is still quite like that. That was super cool. Trying to think of who else, sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
You know, it was funny. It was a really interesting role to do on Life, this cop show called Life. But I got to work with Damian Lewis, and he was really interesting, really good guy. He's in Billions now. And, you know, I thought I liked doing that. I loved working on Damages. You know, that's a really great series. And I got to have scenes with Rose Byrne, and she was. I sat down across from Rose the first time, and she has these, like, she doesn't pluck her eyebrows. They're just like these great bushy, and she's so beautiful, and she's very down to earth. And I just looked at her, and I was looking at her eyebrows, and I said, you have the most beautiful eyebrows I've ever seen in my life on a woman. And she burst out laughing. She said, have we even met? And I said, oh no, I'm Kevin. How are you? It's like, they just look like these beautiful, like these perfect, like, you know, like, what would you say? They were just so like caterpillars or something.
Yeah.
Perfectly beautiful. And she, I was doing the scene with her, and it was like, you know, I took everything in my focus because she's just one of these, I think she's like stunningly beautiful and stunningly talented. You know, if a woman's just beautiful, an actress is just beautiful, and she doesn't have real talent, you know, it doesn't turn me on or it doesn't get me excited. I shouldn't say turned on, but doesn't get me excited.
Yeah.
When you're as talented as Rose is and as beautiful as she is, then I'm like, wow, this is cool. This is like, cool. I like that. And really smart. She's so smart. I had so much fun doing Ugly Betty. They were a great group. Very loose, very, very fun. Good show. Really well written and tight. And I told you about New Adventures of Old Christine and
how about Tales from the Crypt?
So that was really cool. It was really cool because Kim was three and a half, four months pregnant, and they had to shoot her mostly. They had to wardrobe her and shoot her because she literally was protruding a little bit. And Kim was a huge star in those days. Michael Ironside was a big star, and Kim was a star, you know, having her first baby. And I remember we had to do a very sexy, like, lovemaking scene or whatever. And we shot it on a boat in Marina Del Rey. And, you know, why we couldn't have shot it on a set. I know why, because they used to shoot Tales from the Crypt in this friggin' building. It wasn't even a soundstage, but they turned this building into a soundstage on Venice Boulevard. And it was a joke, and they had no money. And so we shot on a boat, and there was only enough room in the boat for me and Kim in this bunk bed. And it was a British director who had never really directed. He had always been a credits director. And he had done like the credits for all the Superman movies or some bullshit. And he kept saying, I'm going to make it very sexy. We'll shoot hands and feet. And maybe it was a boat. So he said, you know, we put your feet, Kim, if you can put your feet on the ceiling, you know, that will be erotic or whatever, you know. She had a clause in her contract, no nudity, because Tails would do nudity and stuff.
Yeah.
She, no, I already feel like I'm a whale because I'm 4 months pregnant, right? And I remember that he kept pushing it. And I had done a movie of the week with Kim. Oh, now I'm forgetting whether I'd done the movie first with her. Somehow I knew her. Or maybe I can't forget, remember which I did first, but we worked with her a couple times. Anyway, I said to her, and he kept saying, you know, what if you reach, you know, after you've made love, what would you do, Kim? You know, he says, and we want to make it film noir. So can you smoke a cigarette? The cigarettes are right behind you. And they put the cigarettes behind her and above, and they had put silk sheets. That's the thing. They put silk sheets on the boat. So the sheets were very slippery, silk, you know? And she said, well, if I reach for it, then you know, my breasts are going to be hanging out. And he said, well, you know, do what's natural. It'll be fine. And she's like, no, I'm not doing that. And he said, but we really want you to smoke and stuff. Like, finally, I whispered in her ear and I said, Kim, look, you reach for it. It's okay with you. And I don't care. I truly don't care. I'll put my right hand on your right breast and I'll just keep the sheet right there. And she goes, great. Go for it. Go for it, Kev. So I did that. This guy goes on, and the only other guy, they had a camera on a tiny little pair of what we call railroad tracks, so it could dolly back and forth along the thing. So there's a camera operator, the director, and Kim and me, and a focus puller. That's the only people. They literally had placed mics strategically, so you didn't even have to have a boom operator in there. That's how small this sailboat was, or it felt that confined. And he kept bugging her and he kept bugging her. And I remember she was like, you know, like she had on a pair of pasties and, you know, like a thong or whatever. And I did too. And I finally got so frustrated that I said, you want to shoot some nudity here? Shoot my bare ass. And I whipped my thing and I said, just shoot my bare ass. And they ended up doing that. And, you know, I don't even know if it made it in the episode. It probably didn't, but I was so pissed at him because he put her in a really uncomfortable position and there was no need for it.
Yeah.
Her people had been clear. It was in her contract and why he pushed it, you know, he wanted to be edgy, whatever, you know, it's just bullshit. But I liked it because unlike lots of other Tales from the Crypts, it really was a film noir and it was really done as a psychological thing as opposed to a monster or some gremlin or something like that popping out of a closet, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody was doing them in those days because I remember visiting I remember meeting Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was directing the next episode and he wanted to see, and he came on the set with a cigar. He always had these cigars and he's like, oh, very nice to meet you. And I remember thinking, wow, he's actually a little shorter than me. He's just like this wide, you know? And then I had to come back to do some dubbing there or something the following week after we had wrapped. And, or I was coming out of maybe it was the week we were shooting. I was coming out of my trailer and, oh no, we were shooting. That's right. I was coming out of my trailer and there was this big black limo there. And the driver was leaning, you know, and he was in it like a chauffeur's uniform. And he says, I said to him, hey, man. And I made a joke, like a bad joke, because it was right outside my door. I said, I'm glad my car is here to take me home. And the guy like looked at me like, I've heard that 1,000 times. How boring can you be? And I said, whose car is it? And he says, it's Demi Moore's. And I said, you mean Demi Moore? And the guy looks at me and he goes, Demi Moore. She had told everyone that her name, the pronunciation of her name truly in the French is Demi.
Oh.
So I looked at the guy and I just laughed like, you know, this is another one of those moments where suddenly, you know, everybody in the industry knows her as Demi Moore, but suddenly, you know, she puts her underwear on somehow differently from everybody else.
Yeah.
So I looked at the guy and I just sort of like wryly smiled at him and went, oh yeah, right. Demi Moore. You know, like, sorry, I made that mistake, pal. You know, like what the hell? But that was, I remember having fun with Michael Ironside. I remember it was really fun throwing the guy, the actor that was her husband. I remember it was fun that episode, you know, throwing him over the balcony, and they had a big crash pad there, and, you know, and it was, I remember he was, we were struggling, like he was going to fall, you know, hundreds of feet and all that stuff. It was cool. It was fun.
That's awesome. All right. So I think I know your answer to this, but
no, go ahead.
Cause you told me a little bit about, like how you got into acting and what you were doing before, but let's say in an alternate universe, you never did the acting.
Right.
What do you think Kevin Kilner would be doing right now?
Teaching and coaching. Probably coaching lacrosse and teaching, you know, or coaching football and teaching. I probably would have gone into teaching. Yeah. Cause I grew up in the household of a teacher, you know, yeah. I felt lucky. I had, you know, four or five teacher and coaches in my life that changed my life, like really changed my life. And I know what they meant to me, and I know how they helped me become who I was. I've always thought if I could do that for a kid, you know, I'd feel pretty good about myself, you know. Everybody used to say, including my parents were great. They were nothing but supportive. But my mom would occasionally say, you know, you can always go back to banking because you've been a banker, you know. And I'm like, Mom, never will happen. I'm never going back to that bank. I'll do a lot of other things, but I'm not going to that bank. You know, I mean, I'm a people person. I'd rather be with kids. I'd rather be, you know, doing that. So I'm pretty sure that's what I would be doing, you know.
That's great. Well, you were great. What's the name of that play again that you were?
It's by Joshua Harmon. It's called Admissions. And I think opened in London. I'm pretty sure they told me. And so it's running there. And, you know, we just closed. So, you know, it's, but it'll be going nationwide. I mean, it's already been in New York and DC, but it'll be everywhere. I mean, they'll do it everywhere. They'll do it in San Francisco and LA and Seattle and all that. So, you know, it's a really, really well-written piece of theater, you know. So
awesome. Well, thanks again, Kevin. You're awesome.
Yeah, man. Be well and congratulations on your baby. And
thank you.
Hope this goes well for you.
I hope so too.
When is this air? When is your podcast?
Well, this will probably air probably in like four. I'm trying to do a bunch of the interviews in a row because it's a lot sure. that goes into it. I'm going back to school right now. I work full time.
Wow.
And I had the newborn. So no, it's fun. yeah. Right. No, I love having the opportunity to talk to people. When I first started this, me and my wife were talking, and I was like, it's either I'm going to get a response or I'm going to get no response.
Yeah.
And the people have been, everybody I've talked to has been great.
That's cool.
Not one person I've talked to, you know, people that are in one movie, like the kid that was in Ace Ventura Jr. I don't even know if you knew that they made an Ace Ventura Jr.
No.
Yeah. It was like a big budget movie and it kind of like fell apart. So it never got released. And it was just bought by like Cartoon Network. And like, he was really cool. He's local. He's from Jersey. He lives in New York now doing a bunch of improv classes. He's only like 25 or 24. No, but like everybody I've talked to is like super awesome. So, and you're on that list now. So thanks again, man.
Like, thanks, man. It was really fun talking to you. And, yeah. and I truly wish you all the best with this yeah. and with your family.
Go ahead. I wish you the best. I'm sure I'll see you on TV soon.
Okay, man. Pleasure. Take awesome. Care.
Bye. Those stories were so great, weren't they? Kevin's a really great dude and he comes off, just maybe it's a background in lacrosse, being on a national championship team with such a great coach, but just a great guy. And he loves acting. You know, he talked about it. He would do some free roles for student films, just really anything to act because he loves what he does. So I put his IMDb link in the notes so you could go check him out some more. And now the trailer for next week's movie.
Hit comedies will often spawn a sequel like the Police Academy and the Porky series. Meatballs 3, Summer Job is the last in a long line of lasts. Recorded in stereo, Meatballs 3 is now available on video.
School's out, it's summer again, and the party's just getting started. So come on along. Join the Meatballs for fun, sun, and plenty of crazy action. And after sexy angel Sally Kellerman hits Heaven's Gate,
it's just the way I picture it.
She's sent to Earth to earn her wings.
I think I've gone from horny to crazy.
It was going to be tougher than I thought.
And the whole place goes topsy-turvy when she turns the camp nerd into the last word in love.
But you'll always be a loser.
I wouldn't think that if I were you.
So join Sally Kellerman.
Get some rest, kid. Tomorrow's a big day. Come with me.
In Meatballs 3.
Okay, so I gotta be honest. I didn't even know they made a Meatballs 2, let alone a third. But I, for one, am happy they did. Find it. It's on YouTube. It's free. You'll thank me. You'll put me in your will. It is awesome. So subscribe to us so you don't miss out on this one, and tell your friends. They'll love all these stories and the comedy things that we try to do. Or you can just laugh at us, whatever you want to do. Please write us a review and follow us on Twitter @sequelsonly. Good night.